Welcome to another episode of the Politatine Podcast. You are currently listening to the one-hour segment of our podcast. To listen and watch the full conversation, head over to politatine.com and click the Watch tab in the top right. If that's not your thing, we appreciate you and hope that you enjoy the episode. And we're rolling. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Politatine Podcast. My name is Damien Galvin, and as always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Varun.
Hey everyone, my name is Varun Kadathala. I'm the co-host of the Politatine Podcast, back again for another wonderful episode with Damien here today, talking about a lot of things that have happened since our last episode. I always say this, but this time it's really, really important because we have Israel-Palestine, the conflict going on right now. We had, you know, a Board of Education meeting in our own county, Forsyth County, about the diversity and equity and inclusion plan of our Board of Education. And Damien spoke at that event. We'll talk about that in a minute here. We had so many things happen even today with Rashida Tlaib. I don't know how to pronounce her last name, but she confronted Biden last night, I believe, at the before he left for the Ford plant, about the Israel-Palestine handling, like the situation's handling. We had so many things happen today in terms of like conflicts in that area. But I'm excited to talk to you, Damien, about these issues. But first of all, let's talk about ourselves. How you doing, man?
Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. How have you been? I've been keeping busy. It feels good that the school year is, wrapping up. We're going to be able to grind Politatine. Hopefully, we're actually going to have our first episode, like, with each other in person very, very, very soon. We're getting that set up, just going to order some things, and hopefully we can start making that the new norm. That vaccine CDC guidelines changing. I don't even know if the CDC.
We didn't talk about that in the introduction. Yet. We got to talk
but
about
the CDC
that.
CDC guidelines changed, man. Me and you went out to get breakfast, had a meeting this morning. It's good. It's good. It's everything's coming back to normal. But I don't think that, you know, just because things are coming back to normal means that we got to stop, making sure that everyone has access to the vaccine. And just because me and you can go out and not wear our mask anymore, we got to still incentivize people to get vaccinated. So, if you or anyone that you love is not vaccinated and has the potential to get vaccinated, go out and get vaccinated.
Right.
It's important. It's crucial. And something that I learned about was that, like, there's these hotspots of people because, you know, people have similar political ideas based on where they live. So there's hotspots of people that aren't vaccinated. And this causes the disease to be able to mutate within those hotspots.
Right. And it's a huge issue. I mean, there's oftentimes like false stories and myths about the vaccine that people believe in. And I would just say, look at the science, read reputed sources, go to the New York Times, go to the, you know, I don't know you don't like that one as much right now with this Israel-Palestine thing going on right now, but I know, look at reputable sources and find your information. And, you know, beyond that, I think that the biggest incentive for those who aren't vaccinated yet is to look at us not having to wear a mask anymore via the CDC's guidelines and say, you know, I can be able to come back to life in a semi-normal landscape if I do get my vaccine. So I think the reasoning behind kind of the CDC recommending that for us not having to wear a mask is to incentivize those without the vaccine to go out and get their own vaccine. And I think to a degree, it's been working in my own circle of friends. I know some of our Politatine associates, staff members have been incentivized to get vaccines because of that. I've heard those stories. And people really just want to get outside and back to moving again. NYC with Mayor de Blasio opened up earlier today or yesterday, I believe, and they have been, bustling. But I think, you know, they've had it, you know, 8 months since the first shutdown in NYC. It's been a long time coming for them. But the one thing I've seen is that hesitancy from these business owners and citizens to take off their masks, even when they're fully vaccinated. And I think that that's okay. We should embrace that hesitancy. But I think for me personally, it's been a hard decision. But my guiding truth was that if I don't take off my mask now when I'm fully vaccinated and the chance of me spreading the virus or getting the virus is extremely, extremely low, as for Dr. Fauci this morning, I think I would never take it off after this. Like, this is my one opportunity to really take off my mask and come back to normal as opposed to, like, you know, staying in this mask situation. So that's my opinion on it. I think that if you want to do it, if not, no. But the one thing that should be clear to all of us is to get the vaccine and get, safe from the virus as soon as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one thing that's like really frustrating me, right, is like New York's coming out of kind of the quarantine, I guess, like all these COVID guidelines and like everything's coming back to normal. But man, Republicans can never just take a victory. And I'm referring to specifically the governor of Texas. And while New York is, you know, coming out and they're like, okay, we're going to get rid of these, the mask mandate, you can take off your mask, don't worry about it. The governor of Texas has to take it one step further and now ban mask mandates. Like, that's not, right. That, like, it's not productive. It doesn't do anything. You're just trying to get political clout. And they keep talking about politicizing an issue. You are literally taking away people's freedoms, right? Like, talk about state intervention. Talk about going against people's liberties. Talk about not supporting the free market. If a business place wants to mandate masks, then it's their right to mandate masks. Right. If a business place wants to make sure that all of the people that enter their establishment has shoes on, it's their right to do that. A business can do any practice so far as it is legal. And by impeding on this practice, it goes against Republican values wholeheartedly.
Uh-huh. And it's funny because their whole premise is that I'm going to be pro-market, pro-capitalism, exactly. Pro-free business and whatever, but they're constricting upon a business's right to impose mask mandates. So I guess, you know, it only works when it is suitable for them, their ideology. Yep. And we saw a little bit of that with the January 6th Insurrection Commission that's proposed to happen, almost like a 9/11-esque commission to investigate the exact optics of what happened, how it was organized, and how it was like the infrastructure of what happened there. Mm-hmm. And like 20 or 30 or even more Republicans are against that commission. And led by Mitch McConnell and led by Kevin McCarthy, the guy in the House earlier, I believe this week. And so it's really stressful seeing that this situation, which is supposed to be bipartisan, right? We can't have, you know, partisanship on the issue of like terrorism, of domestic terror, even more so. And I think that the fact that we still have partisanship on this issue just shows that there is no compromise to be struck in. Oftentimes, I like to talk about compromise and about Democrats and Republicans coming together in harmony in some realistic, unrealistic world, to be honest with you. It's hard because when there's a bipartisan idealistic, that's what I was trying to mention. But when there's a bipartisan issue that we can't deny on, the fact that like January 6th was domestic terror and it should be investigated to the highest degree, it's hard for them to admit to that. Yeah. And that's what really like, you know, impedes upon, stifles my dream of bipartisanship. And even with President Biden's American Rescue Plan, the fact that Republicans were against that, even though Democrats with the CARES Act that Trump passed all supported that CARES Act, even though President Trump's name was attached to it, they knew that Americans needed that support and needed that money. So it's hard being a Democrat and being like a centrist bipartisan individual to continue to advocate for that kind of bipartisanship when really it's one side wanting that bipartisanship and, you know, working towards it and one side denying that even when the issue is abstract. Like a baby could tell if a guy's going to a Capitol building, it's not them being tourists, you know, it's them breaking down windows. It's them shooting, I mean, having guns at the Capitol building. No tourist brings a gun to the Capitol building. And apparently one Georgia representative believed they were tourists. So that's what I'm mentioning here. It's the blatant, you know, being blind to the issues and being partisan when it suits you.
Yeah, no. And the whole tourist argument, that's cool, boss. Like, I wouldn't even put that above them. Honestly, some of them are such hogs that they genuinely, I wouldn't even be surprised if they actually did believe. They're like, oh, look, they want pictures. They want pictures. Yeah,
I forgot they would want a gun in the Capitol building for sure. I mean, what's her name? Oh, yeah. Lauren Boebert wanted to bring a gun into the Capitol, the Congress like deliberation room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, just in case things get heated, dog. Sometimes on the congressional floor, man, you know, someone's proposing a resolution. You just got to tap the waist. Like, you know how police come up to your car and they're like, do you know what I'm stopping you for? They're tapping their waist. That's what you got to do on the congressional floor. So you should vote for my bill. Just tapping the gun on the side.
We always ask, like, what's the need for a gun? There it's like, what is the need? Like, seriously, what is the need for a gun when you're in a room full of representatives? Like, you know, protecting yourself? No, they're all representatives.
Speaking of the need. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of the need of a gun or need for a gun. You know, when I was speaking, I was talking to you about this earlier at the meeting that we were having. When I was speaking, man, I went to the Board of Education and I was sitting down. I'm in there for about like 5 minutes and I hear yelling in the hallways, like yelling, like scared yelling. bro, I swear, I thought, like, I was like, oh, this is how it goes. Like, you know, there's about to be a shooting here. And like, you know, oh man, I was genuinely like, I was like, man, you know, where can I look for cover? And It's something to laugh about now, but man, this is America. Like, seriously.
Yeah.
Like, genuinely, in the country that people in that room were saying is the best country in the world, everyone in that room forgot their political values, forgot the reason they were there. Everyone in that room was scared. Everyone turned around, looked at the doors. The police officers were scared. In apparently the best and safest country, and, you know, arguing for the land of opportunity. Yeah, an opportunity to get shot inside of the Capitol. I wouldn't even put it above a congressional representative to take a gun to the Capitol. But you know who needs a gun? AOC and Bernie Sanders. Because no one's going to go and shoot the Republicans.
Imagine Bernie shooting a gun. That'd be a cool sight. That'd be a sight for the eyes. No, he would never shoot a gun. I don't think so.
I think maybe he has.
Maybe he would. I don't know. I know Biden floored a Ford, electric Ford, yesterday.
Oh, yeah. Did you hear his interaction with the...
Rashida Tlaib?
With the... I don't know. No, the reporter.
No, I didn't hear about that. Oh, yeah, reporter. When he said he would run over her or something. Yeah, I was like, dude, go Biden, man. Like, look at him standing up for himself and stuff. But
I think, I don't know. I think that it was
Fox
a joke.
News killed him, by the way.
Yeah,
it was a joke, for sure. It was a joke. It was no question about it. And they made it like, you know, point of contention. Like, come on, man. Like,
well, the thing is, and a lot of people were saying that, like, oh, if Trump would have said this, it would have been so different. The left would have been eating this up and saying that he wants to. The thing is, Trump doesn't have good delivery when it comes to jokes, because like everything that he's saying is so funny that you don't know what's a joke and what's not. Like, Biden literally went, I'm just teasing afterwards. Like, he made it very apparent that it was a joke. Trump would have been like, I'm going to run you over if you keep asking me these stupid questions. And then, like, later, his press secretary would have come out and been like, oh, he was just kidding.
Yeah.
You know, it was like,
it's like with the what is it called? Injecting detergent?
Yeah.
Detox, whatever that
exactly,
is.
Exactly. Yeah. Febreze.
Like, mange or something? Febreze. Yeah. Clorox, that's what it was.
Clorox.
And she had to say, like, you know, he was joking or something. And he came out, he's like, no, I wasn't joking or something like that. I forgot about it. But like these things often, like they slip my mind, to be honest with you. These things actually happened. A president said, inject Clorox into your veins to get rid of COVID-19. That sounds like a really good idea. And behind him, I saw one of our health directors, like, just nodding, like not nodding her head, but shaking her head left and right. I was like, she knows. She knows he's not joking right there. I mean, he was being 100% straight up President Trump. But that's what makes me scared.
President who?
President, who? Former President Trump.
Who? I don't know who you're talking about.
Oh,
I don't know.
Yeah, we don't talk about that man anymore.
It goes 43, 44, 46.
Forget about that, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Honest. And Geoff Duncan is trying to make a whole new GOP, a whole new Republican Party movement called GOP 2.0. And he kind of recruited Liz Cheney. He went to the Capitol today, and he's talking to Liz Cheney and some other people. I don't know who he was pictured with, but he's basically not going back to his post as lieutenant governor or running for re-election in that position. And he's just going to, you know, commit full time to making a whole new party. And he calls it the GOP of, I believe, ethics and of morals. Yeah. And I think it's a good, you know, start. It's a good start to have a party like that. I mean, on Twitter, they have like 100 followers. So I don't know how legit they are. Mm-hmm. But the fact that he met with a person like Liz Cheney shows that he's willing to make a compromise on certain issues, at least of like moral or like ethical orientations.
I think we should start coming up with slogans for them. Like, still racist, but not just as racist. You know what I'm saying? Or like, still racist, but don't support the
racist.
Orange man. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're just not like, on it. Like,
I know it. Going back to dog whistles.
Yeah.
Make America dog whistles again.
Yeah.
Or repealing the bullhorn.
I think I'm going to give them a chance because I know they've done some bad things in the past, but I believe there's a road towards bipartisanship. In this nation. I know there was some kind of a bill signed by Governor Kemp. I got to look it up, but apparently Ahmaud Arbery was there and he was signing it with Governor, not him, but his family was there signing with Governor Kemp and Lieutenant Governor Geoff Duncan. But like, I think there's a road towards compromise, but that begins with just understanding, mutual understanding of like, you know, moral issues, right? Like January 6th should not be of contention. We have to, you know, commit to those commissions and promote like the good faith in those issues.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. Like, I genuinely, listen, I criticize the Democratic Party as much as anyone. Like, I criticize, right. I think right. I criticize the Democratic Party more than most Republicans do. And I criticize them more aggressively. But one thing that I just can't deny, and I'm bipartisan in this nation, and I'll tell you why I'm bipartisan. I'm bipartisan because I'm so far to the left on issues that I disagree wholeheartedly with both parties. So, you know, it's like the irony where it just takes me back to the center. Yeah. Like, I can criticize these two parties from an outsider's perspective. Man, the Republicans just never want to compromise. It's like they just, the whole party has a pride issue. Like, the complete, right. I just can't understand it. They're like, no, insurrection didn't happen. No, 9/11, we had no fault in it. No, Iran still has weapons of mass destruction. Like, everything, they just like go, I mean, against.
What is the belief based upon? It's the idea that America's perfect, that we don't make mistakes at all.
Yeah.
And that idea is false, and we know that, but they can't admit that. And so they can't criticize their own nation. Like you said with that, you know, Robert Owens quote, I believe. Is that the one that you always mention? The James Baldwin quote.
James Baldwin.
What was that quote? I forgot about it. Yeah.
It's, I criticize, what is it? I criticize America, something along those lines. I criticize America.
Like, I love her so much, I criticize her.
Yeah. Here, I'll pull it up.
That's the same mission, right? It's the idea that, like, they can't criticize their own nations or their own actions by extension, because they have this God complex of America being the best country in the world. And there was, like, at the Board of Education, one person talking about how perfect America was without acknowledging the fact that she mentioned the Constitution or Declaration of Independence, whatever it was, and how they talked about equality of all men or whatever. And I was like, bro, yeah. They had slavery back then.
Yeah. You mean, I mean, the dude that wrote that?
You can talk all you want. Yeah. You can talk all you want, but it doesn't change the fact that you're having slaves in your own house. I mean, yeah. You can talk about equality all you want without, you know, whipping slaves.
Exactly.
So I think there's kind of this idea that America's always perfect. It's always been perfect. Mm-hmm. And that's been disproven multiple times. There's no contention about that issue. That should be bipartisan.
The quote is, I love America more than any other country in the world. And exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you want to talk about founding documents, which I get that the Declaration of Independence is technically a founding document, and she mentions the certain inalienable rights that, you know, God gives, or the Creator, sorry, because God isn't even mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, and right. They by default are associating. By the way, God isn't mentioned in any of our founding documents. I just want to make that apparent, like, very, for the Judeo-Christian values that have apparently always been in our country. The first of the, or the biggest part of the founding document, the Constitution, the one that they always go against, the first part of it literally says, like, no, we're not going to force any religion. Right. God's name is never mentioned. Jesus is never mentioned. Abraham is never mentioned. It literally just says Creator. Certain inalienable rights by their Creator.
Yeah.
Like, and these inalienable rights apparently didn't apply to Black people until, what, 100 years later. They didn't apply to women until 140 years later. They didn't then again apply to Black people until 180 years later with the Civil Rights Movement. They still don't apply to poor people. So, like, what are these inalienable rights? And they don't apply to aliens.
I mean, rights to hold slaves for them.
Right?
That was an inalienable rights, basically. Rights to property, to hold
life,
slaves.
Liberty, and property.
That was the idea. Yeah. So I think for context here, at our Board of Education meeting last night, one of the women who spoke was talking about how this plan is going to fail. The diversity, equity, and inclusion plan is going to fail simply because God deems it so. It's because the Judeo-Christian values that were...
There's a lack of God in it.
Yeah, God is not in the plan. She even explicitly mentioned Judeo-Christian values as not being mentioned within that plan. The plan, for context, once again, was a plan focused upon embracing diversity in our schools. Not comprehensive, but it was something that was symbolic to our schools, being like, yes to diversity, yes to African-Americans in our schools, yes to minority teachers. Things like that were given by that plan. And they were saying the plan doesn't embody Judeo-Christian principles. And I looked at my friend in the car I was sitting in as I was watching the speech, and I was like, man, I'm agnostic. And you're Hindu, and you're Islamic. So why do we have to follow those same Judeo-Christian values in our schools? And that woman mentioned the Constitution, the founding documents, whatever you want to call it. I mean, those documents tell us fair and square, and very clear in those documents, is the fact that we have the establishment clause. The religion cannot be established in schools. That's also one of our founding documents. So why can't we adhere to that? Why don't we talk about, you know, all these things about America being perfect? If we're so perfect, one of our perfections is the fact that we established a separation of church and state.
Well, let's say that way. Yeah, if we're so perfect, why don't we say it in the preamble? We only said more perfect, which is something that I always mention. And in order to be more perfect, you have to look at your past faults. And you have to look at past transgressions and actions that have taken place and go, hey, I am different from that. And so in an attempt to be a more perfect union, I am going to change. I am going to pass this legislation. I am going to stop funding Israel that is committing acts of terror and war crimes against the Palestinian people. I understand that I did it in the past. I had good intentions in the past, or hell, I had bad intentions in the past. I knew what slavery was. The country understood it. We understood the impact of Jim Crow laws. We still understand the impact of Jim Crow laws, but are negligent to it. So we have to change and we have to move. By remaining in the status quo, you completely go against the most important founding document in not only American history, but I'd argue at this moment in world history. It's the founding document that is being criticized and critiqued and looked under every single day and judged by other countries and reevaluated, and we're redefining the Constitution. You go against literally the first part of the first part of the Constitution when you refuse to make changes that will make you more perfect, whether that be your county, your state, or your nation. You have to acknowledge past defeats, wrongdoings, victories as well, and reevaluate everything and go, okay, this is what I'm going to keep doing. This is what we're going to stop doing. This is what we're going to educate. This is how our past actions have affected future generations and current generations alike.
Yeah. And I heard a couple of times last night about, you know, presenting the true history to our students and our kids. True history as in, like, from these people, I think they were talking about whitewashed history.
Yeah.
The history that doesn't talk about, you know, for example, when you used it before, Malcolm X. We don't learn about Malcolm X because Malcolm X doesn't fit our mold of a civil, leader against segregation, a person who is like always sitting down and like advocating for peaceful change, right? At that point in time, black people were being killed, were being shot, were being lynched on the streets. Being civil was not an option for many individuals, including Malcolm X, and Malcolm X has arguably a bigger impact upon the civil rights movement than MLK. But we don't learn about him. Why? Because he does not fit our mold of a peaceful leader. And it's disgraceful that our history education is not as comprehensive as it should be. And that's a flaw that I'm willing to admit amongst our teachers and our curriculums.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, that's just a base flaw. We also don't teach the idea that Mahatma Gandhi was socialist. We don't teach the idea that Martin Luther King Jr. didn't die because he was black. He didn't die because he was a civil rights leader. He died literally before attending a protest that was advocating for the unionization and more rights for plumbers in Alabama, right? The March on Washington wasn't just called the March on Washington. It was called the March on Washington for Jobs and Opportunities, if I'm not mistaken. These are things that we purposefully leave out of our history to fit our mold and coincidentally, ironically, tell students how to think as opposed to what to think, which is something that I heard mentioned time and time again by those opposing the diversity, equity, and inclusion plan last night. They always said, we should tell our students what to think, we should tell our students how to think. But when you take certain aspects out of history, or you refuse to acknowledge certain aspects of history, or you change them in a certain way to fit a certain narrative, you are by default telling students how to think.
Right. Because you're leaving out parts of a history that's so complex and so important to our nation and so important to moving forward and stopping these things that have been happening earlier, genocides, and, you know, discrimination against African Americans. We can't learn from our flaws without first of all accepting them and saying they existed, saying they happened. The first step towards compromise and the first step towards changing the way we operate in this nation is through conversation. And we have that every single day, every single, week now on the podcast. I think what I was going to mention in my speech, had I had the opportunity to speak at the BOE, was the importance of conversation. Damien kind of hit on that one too. Without conversations about past wrongdoings, without conversations about, you know, police brutality, we can't make meaningful strides towards solutions on these issues. And people oftentimes yesterday talked about how there's a certain age you have to get to have the mental capacity to comprehend these issues. The fact is, teens have died as a result of police brutality. There's obviously not a certain age in which you are now exposed to police brutality issues. You know, it's like we learn about these things from a young age, not from education, but from personal experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, you saw your father get arrested.
Yeah.
So it's a testament to how these things affect us in our lives, and learning about them would only just increase our compassion towards our community and our understanding of history and the way forward in this nation. But speaking of history and current events, we had a lot happen today in the Israel-Palestine conflict. I mean, President Biden I talked to Damien about this yesterday, about how he was negotiating a peace treaty and a peace between, you know, Israel and Palestine and the Palestinian Authority. And today, President Biden said he was hopeful towards a ceasefire on the issue. And Benjamin Netanyahu came out, I think a couple hours later, and he said that they're going to keep on going, that they're inspired by President Biden's support and his kind words, but they're determined to keep on going. And it was like a slap in the face to the United States, who has been trying to advocate for change in wrong ways. We'll talk about how they've been doing so later. But it's a slap in the face to say, I'm going to disregard the words of an American president and keep going on with, you know, bombing children, bombing individuals. And this has been talked out, spoken out against by multiple individuals, including Iran spoke out against it. The Islamic League spoke out against it, Arab League, actually. France is now negotiating a peace between these two countries using like their neighbors, Egypt and Jordan. But nations have been up and stood up against these issues. And so it's a very complex thing, but it shouldn't be for many people. I mean, I've seen posts on Instagram from our friends and our associates at school, and they've talked about how Israel's not in the wrong, that they're defending themselves. And me too, I was, you know, after reading some articles, I was kind of going towards that side. Mm-hmm. But then I understood what the Iron Dome was. We'll talk about that a little bit, but I want to hear your takes on the whole issue.
I remember you were texting me and I was like, there's no way that, you know, that there's this, that there's this sudden change in your ideas. And honestly, you made a full 360 from that point. I'd argue that you even made, you know, furthermore, like you just went past, you went beyond like opposite. You made a 360 and then you hit a straight line and you started coming back over to, I guess, the left progressive idea on this issue. But essentially, what is happening and what has always happened in Israel is the blaming of Hamas and the justification of these war crimes by going back to the default that, well, Hamas was there. Well, Hamas was there, or Hamas is doing it too. Or Hamas, always never mentioning of the Palestinians, never mentioning of the children that they kill in trying to go after Hamas. Besides the prime minister on Face the Nation saying that he gives their condolences and they feel sorry for the citizen or the civilian deaths that result. But it's disgusting. And I don't know if you know the statistic, but it's disgusting when all the missiles, the rockets that Israel is launching, they have a 5% chance of hitting a Hamas fighter. They have a 5% chance of hitting a Hamas fighter. They have a 45% chance of hitting a child. When your chances of hitting a child are almost 9 times higher than hitting your intended target with your precision attacks, I have to ask, first of all, who is your intended target? And if they aren't the children, are these attacks precise? Because first of all, I believe that their intended target isn't Hamas. Because if it was, there's different means to eliminate them without going after their true intended target, the Palestinian people.
Right.
The Palestinian children. The average age of Palestinians is 18 years old. In the United States, it's 29. This is a testament to lack of healthcare because, by the way, Israel was also not giving the COVID-19 vaccines to Palestinians. As a matter of fact, they blew up their only COVID-19 research center. It is atrocious and it's disgusting. And what is essentially happening is they're saying, okay, well, Hamas was there. One Hamas fighter was there. One Hamas, you know, person was there. An individual. Hamas was operating there. I gave this example on my Twitch stream last night. I said, imagine there's a murderer in your house, right? Your whole family. Let's say you have a family of four. Your parents, you, and your sibling. And a murderer comes in and seeks refuge inside your house. So the U.S. government just nukes you. But they give you a call an hour beforehand telling you, hey, you should leave your house. But we're also nuking your neighbor's house. Oh, and we're also nuking your whole neighborhood. As a matter of fact, we're nuking your whole county. So leave your house, seek refuge, because we're going to bomb it. And make sure that the place where you're seeking refuge isn't also getting bombed. Just kidding, it is. It doesn't matter where it is because we're dropping a bomb on it. Everywhere you go, you're dropping a bomb. And what's happening is that they're saying that Hamas is committing these war crimes, right? They're committing war crimes because they're firing from civilian locations. Where, first of all, where else are they going to fire from? The only thing that Palestine is now is civilian, areas of living.
Right.
Residencies. Right. You only have residencies. You have confined these people to such a tight space. And then the prime minister has the audacity to tell Hamas, hey, why don't you not fight from the cities? Why don't you move your weapons and your fighters to an area where we can more easily find you so we don't have to kill Palestinians? Hamas has more and listen, screw Hamas. I hate Hamas. I'm not defending them. I'll never defend them. They're a terrorist organization. Just as much as the Israeli government is a terrorist organization. But Hamas has more common sense than the Israeli government because they go, hey, maybe if we put a baby in front of the IDF, they won't shoot them. Hamas has more common sense and more dignity and more respect than the Israeli government because they go, hey, maybe if we hide inside a house, the Israeli government will have the decency to not kill us because there's a family living there. But on the contrary, the Israeli government is targeting the families instead of the Hamas fighters who do use human shields, who do hide in residencies, who do, put weapons inside of schools. But it's wrong. You can't just blow everyone up like we did in the Middle right. East after right. 9/11.
Right. And I think it is a atrocious incident what's happening right now. I mean, you're talking about countless bombing of civilians, individuals. You have like 64 children who died, I believe, in Palestine, if not more.
It was 64 in one incident, which was one in third, one incident? Which was one third of the civilian deaths.
Yeah, I want you to find out if you can the stats on like civilian deaths because I don't know what they are off the top of my head. Yeah. But what I do know,
it's thousands in the whole conflict.
Right, it's thousands. You know, thousand plus injured, I believe, in Palestine, and like 600 died. No. I believe
thousands thousand.
I don't think so. That's not what I read.
In the whole conflict, I'm talking about the whole conflict.
Oh, the whole conflict? The whole conflict.
And since 2014, there has been thousands.
Oh, you mean 2014? Yes. I mean, these 10 days is what
these
I'm talking
10 days,
about.
I wouldn't be surprised if it even...
64 was what the toll count for kids was in Palestine. I think what's happening right now is you're seeing bombing from Hamas, which is a terrorist organization, not some kind of a government, not some kind of a, you know, international government, but a terrorist organization, towards, you know, Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and these places. But the thing is that Israel has defenses, aerial defenses. The Iron Dome, as I mentioned before, is a intricate system of aerial defenses to protect Israel against these bombs, and it's extremely effective in doing so. But Palestine has no such thing. Hamas is a ragtag terrorist organization with no such thing. And because of that, every single bomb that Israel fires almost always hits its target. Like Damien said, those targets are often civilians and individuals with no role as a combatant, but they hit their targets without some kind of an aerial defense. And Israel is really shielded from those targets and from those bombs by their Iron Dome. So they have no reason to be, you know, bombing individuals. They can, you know, abide and live by themselves in security for as long as they really want with the Iron Dome. I mean, the problem is Netanyahu this morning, he said, Israel's pushing forward to return the common security to you, citizens of Israel. They could have common security even without firing missiles. Why? The Iron Dome. So right now, they're firing missiles only to spew fear, as Damien kind of implied in what he said, towards Palestinians, in Palestinians, and make them, you know, advocate for peace, advocate for rescinding their rights and willfully leave their homes, which is what this conflict began with. I don't know if you guys know this, but the conflict began with individuals telling Palestinians to leave their homes because those are not their homes anymore, because Jews had held those homes for history. So this is how the conflict began. Ethnic relocation, forced relocation. And
to a certain degree, I would say that's inaccurate because historically Israel has not been the home of the Jews. Now it was the promised
land. I'm just saying it's their claim.
Yeah, that's their claim. Right. Their claim is that they're entitled to the land because God said so.
Uh-huh.
Because the dude in the cloud said so, they're entitled to the land. And then what's happening now is that Israeli Jews are moving into Palestinian territory and just going, as the man from Brooklyn said, if I don't take it, someone else will. So I'm going to take your house. This is my house now. Literally. Mm-hmm. In looking up the death toll, just verifying it, it was 212 as of 2 days ago. 212 Palestinians killed compared to 10.
10, yeah.
Israelis killed. Okay,
I believe now 64 I'm not saying, or so are kids in
yes,
Palestine. As well.
Yeah, it was about 64. Just to make sure, 64, yeah. Which is about, you know, again, one third of the deaths.
More than one fourth. Yeah.
One third of the deaths are children. One third of the deaths are children. Okay, so let's say even in this circumstance, the rest of the people that you are killing, every single one of them is a Hamas fighter. Even then, it's not justified. Even then, you can't say, hey, we killed, what would that be, 150 Hamas fighters. Whoops, we accidentally killed 64 children. You can kill 150 of the worst people on the planet. That mm-hmm. does not excuse killing 64 children. Now, in searching for this, I also found one of the reasons that I have been criticizing all forms of media, especially the New York Times recently. Here you go. Here's the quote. Civilian deaths on both sides raise urgent questions about which military is causing them. Civilian deaths rise on both sides. So you're going to equate 200 deaths to one Palestinian or to one Israeli death. Because technically, one is a rise from zero. But you can't equate that from a rise of zero to 200. You can't say deaths are rising on both sides. It's this type of liberal writing that is causing the U.S. to feel like they can support Israel. It is this type of liberal writing in American news media that is causing Israel and the prime minister of Israel, the illegitimate criminal who is holding the office of prime minister in Israel, to say things like, we will not stop until we hear a deafening silence from Palestine. Those aren't words of peace. Those are fighting words.
Right.
So how are you going to let a terrorist organization ask for peace while you're requesting deafening silence?
Right. But one key thing to remember is that even though these things are happening, it's not an excuse for anti-Semitism. I mean, you had Turkey's leader Tayyip Erdogan, I believe it's the prime minister, who said all the Jews are satisfied by is by sucking individuals' blood in light of what happened with Israel and Palestine. It's no excuse to be anti-Semitic, to be discriminatory yeah. against Jewish individuals, because really, absolutely. It's not Judaism. It's not Jewish individuals. It's Benjamin Netanyahu and his own personal vendetta against Palestine and those individuals there. And so it's not going to be equated to those people, but it has been in some certain places. I mean, you had British people coming out on the streets and saying death to Jews in 2014.
That was fake. That was an altered audio where they were protesting it and someone put in the audio in the background saying death to all Jews. That was an altered clip. I know exactly what you're talking about.
The man was arrested.
It's all of it in was Britain. Fake.
Really? All of it was on all the NY Times.
All of it was fake. All of it was fake. It was the
on
same
the
thing
NY
with
Times?
All of it was fake. It was the same thing with the makeup artist.
Well, send me an article about that.
Where they're talking about, have you heard, you know, Pallywood?
No, I haven't.
With Pallywood, they're basically saying that, like, Palestine is hiring makeup artists to paint makeup on children and make it seem like, you know, they're dead or whatever. And so they got this clip of a Palestinian doing makeup 10 years ago, like for Halloween or whatever, or just, you know, cosmetic makeup. And they said that she was practicing and they started surfacing it as propaganda. It's the exact same thing that they did.
Well, I don't see any news about this is why I'm skeptical, but I still want to continue the conversation.
Yeah. Certainly.
Because all I see is the NY Times saying that this happened.
Certainly.
But they could be wrong. I mean, they're pretty reputed, but they could be wrong in some scenario. But anyways, beyond that, it's been happening for a long time. You saw in 2014, specifically, there was British people who were throwing rocks at individuals' stores and storefronts who were Jewish. And so it's like what happened, you know, in 1930 is what I would equate it to. When people in Germany were throwing rocks and rocking or stoning individuals who were Jewish and breaking down their establishments. It happened in Britain in 2014, and it has the opportunity to happen now with resurfaced anti-Semitism. So just saying that it's not an excuse to be anti-Semitic and not an excuse to be even more discriminatory than the Israelis are being towards Palestinians, because you're doing the exact same thing as them by doing so. But back to the conversation, what we're dealing with right now is the U.S. government, you know, wanting to send get $735 million in money for U.S. arms equipment that are JDAMs, which are Joint Direct Attack Munitions and small diameter bombs to Israel. And these are things they're using right now to bomb Palestinians. So we're dealing them the equipment for money, $735 million, not a small amount, but we're dealing them equipment to essentially bomb Palestinians. Mm-hmm. And so you can't say the administration is not complicit in what's happening right now. You can talk about how Biden is, you know, calling for peace, but really we're doing the exact opposite. We're going to be doing it, if not for AOC and Rashida Tlaib, who is once again the first American-Palestinian representative in Congress, and, you know, Mark Pocan's plan, which says we should not send this money over to Israel because it's going to cause the death of children. And whose hands is that blood going to be on? The U.S. and Israel.
We don't have a problem with it because they're brown children.
Right. And also our name's not directly tied to it. Yeah. It's Benjamin Netanyahu. Well,
we wouldn't care if it was. The bombs that we dropped in Syria are directly tied to us. We don't care.
American media wouldn't mention it.
They're brown. That's why. Exactly.
Why our name isn't tied to it. It would be tied to it if American media wasn't so skewed sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when it comes to being Zionist and being and Joe Biden, honestly, is being Zionist. He's being completely Zionist. And it's very wrong when he's saying that, you know, Israel does have the right to defend itself. The right to defend itself. And
but not to,
to not attack. Not to attack.
But they have defenses, though. The Iron Dome's a defense for them, sure, which is, you know, really accurate and really useful in their defense.
Exactly.
But they have no right to attack children.
Exactly.
Like, that's against international humanitarian law, which is what the UN follows.
Yeah. Well, the UN tries to follow, at least. The UN's a joke, too.
But. Right. And they're trying to now as well.
Yeah.
The UN Security Council is trying to say that the conflict right now is a blatant, you know, rejection of human rights and saying Israel's in the wrong. But the U.S. is saying now that they can't say that because it would basically undermine opportunities for peace. So now the UN Security Council can't talk about how Israel's in the wrong because it would undermine the opportunity for peace. No. Because who's in the wrong right now? It's a factual statement to say Israel's in the wrong because statistically, they've killed more people, they've killed more kids, and they've killed more, peaceful individuals in the conflict. So I think it's the U.S. honestly trying to up its public image and to keep an ally as opposed to supporting human rights. And I applaud Emmanuel Macron in France for fighting for peace, no matter what's happening in the conflict, no matter what the Americans are saying, for going forward with that argument, and for vehemently, saying that Israel's in the wrong here.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's very apparent and it's very obvious that Israel is in the wrong here. There is no other perspective on it unless you are just completely Islamophobic or Zionist. Right. And it's very interesting to hear uneducated people. And this is what I have discovered, right? It's like, it doesn't matter how much empirical evidence you show people on, you know, the other side of this issue. And other side of other issues too. It's the same thing with gun rights. And that's why, honestly, this generation is so far skewed ideologically to the left. you know, this generation is the most progressive generation. This generation is the most leftist generation because we have learned, ironically, how to critically think. And we go, hey, there's more to an issue beyond what's on face value. And on face value, you can make an argument for anything. If I just told you, hey, Israel is trying to defend itself from terrorists, that is true. Israel, I do not deny that. Israel is trying to defend itself from terrorists. In the process, they're killing thousands of people who do not deserve to be killed. They are wrongly defending themselves, so much so that they are acting as aggressors and they are committing war crimes. Okay, so I do not dissent on the opinion that Israel is trying to defend itself. Just like I do not dissent that technically white people are trying to defend themselves from, you know, the, what's it called? Culture.
Critical race theory.
Yeah, yeah. They're trying, like, or well, no, like they're trying
reverse racism or something.
No, they're trying to defend themselves from, man, what's it called? Like when all white people go extinct or whatever
like majority, minority, whatever.
Yeah. So technically, by, you know, committing hate crimes, white people are defending themselves from this idea. Technically, yeah.
We can argue that for sure, but it's not going to be accurate. It's not going to be.
On face value, that's the thing. On face value, these, you know, the people that protested, I guess, at the Capitol were protesting a faulty election. But when you look at the reason, when you look beyond face value, you know, that's when you get to the true problem behind, that's how you get to the true issue behind things. You know, you can always just look at issues from the face value. And that's what I talked about this before. That's what the Republican Party does. They just go, here's the picture. We're not going to tell you the story behind it. What does your common sense tell you? That's Republicans' favorite word. Common sense approach. It's common sense to see that Israel is defending itself. It's common sense. But it's not common sense. Sometimes you have to transcend beyond common sense and go into critical sense.
Right. Understand. And to critique everything you see.
Exactly.
And that's what I did yesterday, looking at the NY Times. I looked at Al Jazeera, different news sources to find every bit of information I could about the issue. And I think people don't have the time sometimes to find all the information. But when you have time, do your research, do your reading, and, you know, find everything there is to know about an issue. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, beyond that, what we can do in this conflict is to not send $735 million over to Israel to fund their activities. People often ask me, like, what do you do? Like, what is the solution here? Like, how do you stop what's happening? First of all, don't, you know, support it monetarily. Don't support it with arms. And don't support it with your mouth. Like, don't say that Israel is in the right here, because really clearly they're not. If 64 children are dying, an institution, an aggressor is not in the right. They're murderers, to be honest with you.
They are.
And, you know, once again, defense is their iron dome. That's already there, okay? There's no reason for them to be doing these kinds of things. And, you know, Hamas has said, their spokesperson has said that he would consider pleas for peace once Israel stops bombing the Gaza Strip.
Yes, so, which is what I told, which I, so I clearly, talked to you about in the text messages. If Israel wants to get rid of Hamas.
Well, once again, consider. The word consider is still there. There's no you know, guarantee that they would have super
peace. Think about a terrorist organization having more decency than a government.
Right.
Because Netanyahu isn't even saying he'd consider.
He's not considering anything.
He's saying he wants deafening silence.
Right. He said you can either conquer them or you can deter them. And he wants to, I think he might want to conquer them, because really he's saying to a meeting, I think today or yesterday, he was saying that he is willing to extend what they're doing right now to do more than what they're doing right now, which means more people killed. Like, those words literally mean more children killed and more individuals killed. So why are we still sending money to allow him to do more things and not sanctioning the nation, not calling for the UN to send, you know, forces to stop what they're doing? And even the UN sent some aid forces into Israel to help Palestinian individuals in Israel, and they're stopped at the border because Israel's saying that there's some kind of security issues with them and Hamas, but really it's them refusing aid for those who are reeling and suffering. Because over 1,000, we talked about 600 or something, or 200 who are dead, over 1,000 are injured, and those individuals need support.
No,
over 1,000 are displaced.
Exactly.
Without homes, and they need help too. So why is the UN, the United Nations, which Israel I believe is a part of, being kept out of its own nation? That's the question.
Yeah, no, and then let's okay, I understand. The 200 casualties are bad, and 64 of them being children casualties, absolutely atrocious, terrible. But it's even worse, and it's a mockery when and I got really aggravated about this last night on my broadcast, when the Israeli Prime Minister, when Benjamin Netanyahu is saying, well, actually, we're the most, he tweeted this, proof that Israel is the most moral army in the world. And he tweets a PragerU video showing why Israel.
Oh
yeah.
Oh my God. He's the Prime Minister.
Showing why Israel, and the defense for Israel being the best army in the world, which is ironic, right? Or the most moral army in the world, because you really moral and army don't really, you know, not words that kind of clash together. That's like, I made the, the comparison last night, that's like, Ted Bundy going, I'm the most moral rapist in history. Like, right. It's two words right. That don't clash. And he goes, well, we call the Palestinians ahead of time and tell them that we're going to bomb their whole family. Yeah, that's like Ted Bundy going, hey, I'm calling you to let you know that I'm going to rape you. You know what I equated it to? It's not moral. It's literally Michael Jordan going, I'm going to sink this three-pointer from 30 feet out. It's telling...
And then doing it without giving you an option to stop it.
And then doing it.
There's no issue. Like, there's no option for you to stop anything.
He's just calling his play, and it's not moral.
You're calling it,
exactly. You're just flexing.
Exactly.
You're literally just flexing on your opponent.
I'm going
like,
to go
hey,
bomb you.
Exactly.
Out of your house.
It's not like, hey, you should get out.
There's no negotiation to say, if you do this, you'll be able to. Even kidnappers say, if you do this, you can get out of the conflict.
Exactly.
They're just saying, we're going to kidnap you. Like,
yeah, we're
going to do about
it. We're just going
to
bomb you. Hey, I'm
so
just
get
calling
away
you,
while you can.
Letting you know right now, this is Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm letting you know we're about to kill your whole bloodline.
No, it's going to be, you're going to be homeless in 1 hour.
No,
and
then
you're going to be jobless. Or without a place to work with the Al Jazeera people and the, what was it? Al Jazeera and who else? Anyways, there was two.
Yeah.
There was two newspapers and their offices were bombed.
Oh, the and Associated Press.
The AP. Yeah. And that's one of the biggest newspapers and organizations in the world. But they bombed two of the biggest news organizations for what reason? Not to, you know, stop Hamas.
Well, that's what they
justified
it as.
Them. They justified it as, once again, they said Hamas had some operatives
resources.
And they had some resources in there. But really, there's no evidence of that to anybody. Nope. I mean, Blinken said that they gave him evidence in some back channels. But really, what is Blinken saying? I mean, like, send us the evidence. We asked for it multiple times. Mm-hmm. But the issue here is that they're targeting civilian facilities. They're targeting news offices. They're supposed to be neutral on the issue. Once again, Al Jazeera is presenting both sides of the issue. So why are they doing this? It's for political reputation. It's all they're doing. And we talk about, you know, people gaslighting news articles, like Trump, for example, saying that news is all fake and biased, but Israel's literally bombing the news. That's like Trump bombing a CNN like facility.
Yeah.
That's outrageous.
Yeah.
Outrageous.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. And then Benjamin Netanyahu said, well, why aren't they building their infrastructure instead? You want to know why? Because yes, again, this is what I was going to say earlier. These 64 deaths, these 212 deaths, 64 child deaths, these 212 deaths total are atrocious. But it's also bad when you're blowing up their only COVID-19 research center, when you're blowing up their hospitals, when you're cutting off their gas lines, when you're literally destroying their sewage systems. I don't know if you saw that. They destroyed their sewage systems and now there is no proper desanitary system inside of this Palestinian locations. And then on top of that, you've blown up so many schools that 600,000 students are missing class currently. So you're not only, and this is something that we have to, again, let me equate this back to the DEI plan, right? We might see the immediate effects of this currently. We might see the 64 deaths now and the 600,000 students that are going without an education currently. But we're going to see the waves from this big drop, the repercussions in 20 years when these kids grow up and they're not as educated, they don't have as many job opportunities presented, they're having health issues because of the fact that they don't have proper water distilleries and all of these things. And then we're going to ignore it and be like, well, we shouldn't talk about that because that's in the past. That happened in the past. No,
right.
It still affects us today. And one thing that I heard talked about over and over again in this DEI plan, the opposition specifically, it said the parents should be the ones to teach their children how to interact with other people in the world. They should teach them about critical race theory if they want. It's not the school's job to do that, right? But what happens is that individuals go in front of the courthouse in our county and yell F them N-words because their parents teach them that that is appropriate. It is not the student's fault. I will say that again. It is not the student's fault. It is the ignorance of the educators that are responsible for educating children on how to properly interact with other individuals of different backgrounds, different experiences, different cultures, different religions, of failing them. Because when you leave that responsibility in the hands of people whose grandparents were racist and whose great-grandparents were racist and who their parents were slave owners, you're going to have individuals that still hold those same or similar values through generations, values that are outdated, values that no longer go with the times. The same thing is happening in Israel. When you're not educating both the Palestinian and Israeli youth that this is a conflict that does not need to go on any longer, that you should not hate thy neighbor, right?
Right.
When you're not educating them in those ideas, you have what results in a conflict that in 30 years is going to hit its 100 years mark. Well, technically, right, it is hitting its 100 years mark because this is when about 100 years ago, European Jews started immigrating to Israel. Right. And you have these constant conflicts because of a lack of education, because of the status quo being reinforced and reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. The same thing is happening here. And the same thing that is happening here is happening to a higher degree in Israel.
Right. And I think, you know, this is what's going to happen and continue to happen here. Like you said, if we don't have real conversations about race and about issues that affect us in this nation, I had our teacher this year, I'm not going to mention her by name, but she oftentimes talked about racial issues in our law class. Mm-hmm. And that really opened my eyes to how much ignorance there was in my secluded community. I thought I was in a place that was a safe haven from racism, a place of equality. And then I see what happened at the Board of Education, what happened in my classroom with individuals in our class saying that white people have it as bad as black people with the cops. And those things are words and statements of absolute, both, you know, factual inaccuracy and ignorance. Mm-hmm. And I think the way we repair these things is not by just saying like what we're saying right now, that they're inaccurate and ignorant, but having conversations with those people and saying, you know, how can we come to a middle ground and explain to them what your experiences are? Because the best, you know, teller of what's happening in a situation is sometimes experience. We talk about experiences a lot. For example, me and Damien, you know, we both heard about this. Like Damien mentioned, people saying F them N words in front of a Black Lives Matter crowd in our own community and playing a song called I Don't Like N Words. This happened in our community with students from our school system. That's why we had this plan, you know, being introduced in the first place. Things like these have been happening in this community. And so without recognizing these experiences, without coming to terms with what happened, we can't ever come to, a better proposal, a better plan in the future. It all begins with, first of all, recognizing our past flaws, like we mentioned for the first half of the episode. Second of all, with having conversations, which is what we're talking about right now.
Yeah. No, and exactly, because when we have these conversations in that classroom setting that we talk about, right?
Right.
What you often hear from these people is, well, my mom told me, my mom also had that conversation with me, which is what was echoed and what is always echoed when you have dissenting opinions about racial issues. Well, my mom also told me to be weary of police officers and to respect police officers. Yes, our parents tell us that too, but you don't understand the difference in that until you have a conversation with someone who has had to have a discussion about the true impacts of racial consequences of systemic racism in their lives. So when you are only being told by, you know, again, a word that, you know, might be strong, a phrase that might be, when you're only being told by your white parents how being white affects you, I'm sorry, that may not be accurate.
Right.
But when you're having conversations with people who have black parents, with people who are Black, with people who are Latino, with people who are gay, and they're talking to you about how the system has directly affected them, then you can gain some outside perspective. When you have counselors that can talk to you about these issues, that can inform you, when you have teachers that look like you and have different experiences and have different backgrounds and can bring a different perspective to teaching these topics, that, you know, it's like talking about your own loss.
Right.
You have to have it from another perspective. You have to view things from another perspective. You know, it's important that we continue to have these conversations and that we continue to advocate for what we believe is right. Because what is happening in Israel and what happened, you know, with this protest against a plan that is meant to include people, while some ways is unrelated and many is related. There was a reference to a Marxist Trojan horse. Right. I argue that by not discussing these ideas, by not having conversations with people of different backgrounds and ethnicities, by not talking about hell, something that the plan doesn't talk about, by not mentioning critical race theory, which honestly should be discussed in areas of academia.
But that plan didn't say anything about CRT.
Yeah, the
but
plan
it should be
not.
Discussed for sure.
It
because
should
it's
be
true.
Discussed. But by not by not discussing things such as critical race theory, by not discussing ideas such as Marxism and capitalism, by not looking at ideas of Milton Friedman, who was an avid capitalist, you lose potential and are inviting a fascist Trojan horse, a Trojan right. horse that only carries one set of ideas. And those ideas are going to be inherently racist.
Yeah, said it perfectly, I think. And I think that I couldn't agree more, for sure. I think there's ways to go forward and to have more done in this community, to have more taught to our peers and the next generation of individuals, because really education is what shapes the next generation. Having quality education is what's going to shape this next generation. And unfortunately, in Palestine, that education's being taken away from many individuals. I saw an Instagram post yesterday from a Stanford person who's going to go to Stanford next year in Palestine. And he was saying, I don't know if I'm going to be able to go to Stanford because I cannot leave my home. I'm taking a gap year because I cannot leave my home without being shot at and maybe bombed. I don't know if I'm going to make it next year. And so I thought it was a routine college acceptance post, but it wasn't. It was this like person saying, I can't go to college, and here's why. And here's why you should advocate against your country sending $700 million, I mean, getting $700 million to support what's happening to me right now. And so I think it's a big issue that needs a lot of conversation to be had. And I'm happy we had a great conversation today. Mm-hmm. And I want to end on the fact that, you know, go out and have more conversations with your friends and continue to voice your opinions about issues, whether they're, you know, for the DEI plan or for Palestine, for Israel, no matter what it is, voice your opinions and also listen to other people, because half of the battle is listening. And many people can't put themselves in other people's shoes because they fail to listen to other arguments on the opposition and the other side. So go out, have those conversations, be receptive to opinions. With that, I'm out, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And go out and have these conversations vaccinated. Because when you're vaccinated, you can go out fully vaccinated. You can go out and take off your mask. Have real conversations. Look at people's facial expressions. Ladies and gentlemen, you shouldn't do that if you aren't fully vaccinated. So go out and get that vaccine. Get that Pfizer. Get that Moderna. Hell, get that Johnson & Johnson.
Right.
Get the vaccine that is nearest to you, because honestly, it is more critical to be vaccinated than to be exposed to this virus. Fortunately, we are at the tail end of this. I think for me and Varun, it is maybe a little bit early, but we're getting to that end. We're done. The battle is over for us. But ladies and gentlemen, what is also over is this episode of Politicine, and we want to thank you for listening to it. If you want to see what we're doing, including going to these places and advocating for things that we advocate here on the podcast, such as the DEI plan and all of these different ideas, inclusion, if you want to see us go to pro-Palestine and pro-Israel protests or demonstrations, and you want to keep up to date with what we're doing, Be sure to follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at Politatine Show. That's where you can see everything that we're doing and everything that we're going to be doing. But ladies and gentlemen, you made it through yet another episode of the Politatine Podcast, and we are so thankful for having you. Be sure to tune into our next episode. Turn on notifications on whatever platform you are so that you are informed when we're informing you. Thank you, guys.
That concludes the hour segment of this podcast. To listen to or watch the remainder of this episode, head over to Politatine.com and click the Watch tab in the top right. Beyond that, thank you for listening to another episode of Politatine.